September 11th changed us, changed the world, and we've had many talks on bioterrorism by members of our staff as well as faculty over the last several years. We actually instated some of the September 11th by providing some programs. And I thought we would have a different perspective of terrorism today with our special guest, Dr. Abu al-Fadl, which I'm sure I mispronounced, but close, who is a distinguished expert in Islamic law. He is one of the leading authorities in Islamic law in the United States and Europe. He joined the UCLA Law Faculty as a visiting professor in 1998. And in 1999 was appointed to the faculty and named a special Omar and Esmeralda Alfi Distinguished Fellow in Islamic Law. He teaches Islamic law, Middle Eastern, investment law, immigration law, and courses related to human rights and terrorism. He was trained in Islamic legal sciences in Egypt, Kuwait, and the United States. After law school, he clerked for Arizona Supreme Court Justice Moeller. He is often called as an expert witness in international litigation involving Middle Eastern law and immigration law, political asylum claims. He previously has taught at the University of Texas at Austin, Yale Law School, and Princeton, and it goes on. He has written several books, and for some reason, I've asked him how this happened, four in the last year. So not only is he a pretty face, but he's able to do all these things, which is incredible. Books such as The Beauty in Islam, published 2001, Rebellion and Violence in Islamic Law, 2001, published by Cambridge Press, Speaking in God's Name, Islamic Law, Authority and Women, which is forthcoming, And God Knows, The Soldiers, 2001, and The Authoritative and Authoritarian in Islamic Discourse, which is the second edition. He is certainly distinguished himself in our community and in the community at large. I've asked him to speak to the issues of terrorism in the Quran, and he's open to any questions you want to ask. I'm not afraid, will not sidestep any questions. He'll speak a while, and then we'll open it up and ask any questions about the Quran, terrorism, or anything else. It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Abu al-Fadl.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to have you here today. Unfortunately, I'm not in top form since fighting the flu, but I thought since I canceled last time, it would not be very polite to do it again. So, excuse me as I sort of drift away fighting my viruses during the lecture, and then come back. The subject of Islam and terrorism is, it's always difficult for me to talk about because of how complex and multifaceted and multi-layered that issue is. It is complex and multi-layered not because of the particular affinity between Islam and terrorism, but because the subject of terrorism in itself is already complex, and Islam is a rich and multi-layered phenomenon and religion. At any case. So it's quite a task to talk about terrorism and quite a task to talk about Islam and even a bigger task to talk about the two of them together. Islam, of course, is a religion, the second largest religion of the world. It's the third of the Abrahamic faith. And a religion which has had the burden and distinction of creating or supporting a world civilization. The reason that this is a burden and distinction is that religions that tend to support the founding of a civilization tend to produce a remarkable amount of complexity, especially in the legal field involved, that is not easy to generalize about or to sum up in simple, faster fashions. So, for instance, Islamic law itself is roughly about 1,400 years old. It is not, as is often assumed by people, a static organism, but rather it is constantly and has been constantly for 1,400 years an evolving interpretive tradition, but unlike the rabbinic tradition, which is hermeneutic in nature, Islamic law has been a rather complex mixture of juristic hermeneutics, as well as actual case law, actual precedents that have taken place over a period of 1,400 years. So, Islam in itself is a complex, especially the product of Islam as a faith, as a religion. Islam is rather simple in its tenets, but as a civilizational phenomenon, it is definitely rich and complex. Terrorism has been with us for centuries, and human intellects have spent much energy in trying to understand what constitutes terrorism and what does not constitute terrorism, and how to distinguish between the right to revolution or the right to national liberation or the right to a lawful use of force or an unlawful use of force, so on and so forth. And again, like Islamic law, terrorism in itself has not remained a static conception, but rather as a legal category, as a theoretical category, has evolved and mutated throughout history. Part of what complicates the picture with terrorism is the tendency for political foes for the past couple hundred years to call their opponents terrorists. So, for instance, we already know that the American revolutionaries themselves were branded by English forces or by English authorities, especially the royal court in England, as rebels, seditioners, and those who pursue horrendous acts of terror. That, of course, doesn't mean that it is an unmeaningful category. It simply means that it's a complex category. So, going back to the issue of Islam itself. As I said, it's a third of the Abrahamic faiths, and Muslims, in a nutshell, believe that Muhammad was the last prophet in the line of Abrahamic prophets. As you might already know, or all of you might know, or some of you might know, that in Islam, Jesus is considered a prophet, Moses is considered a prophet, and Muhammad is considered the final prophet, but then you've got all the biblical prophets considered prophets as well. And the theology is such that God, it's a one single God. In Islam, the God of Christians is the same as the God of Jews, is the same as the God of Muslims, referred to in Arabic as Allah. Of course, Allah is the same word. Allah is actually, it's a Syriac term. It doesn't originate in Arabic. It's a Syriac term which meant that who is powerful and above. That's what the origin of the word Allah is. And it was adopted in Arabic to refer to the divinity before Islam. So before Islam comes into the picture, Allah is already used to refer to that who is high and above and taken from Syria. In any case, when Islam comes along, the Quran uses the term Allah to refer to God. And interestingly enough, that the Arabic Bible, the Arabic New Testament, as well as the Arabic Old Testament, uses either the word Allah or variations like Ilah to refer to God as well. So, in any case, so it's the same God, Muslims believe, that is the God of Abraham and the lineage of the Abrahamic prophets that is sending, importantly, a singular message. That it's the same essential message. Belief in one God, indivisible, all-powerful, immutable, etc., etc., and that part of the system of belief is that while creeds before Islam were sent to specific tribes or people, Islam is sent universally. In other words, to all human beings. Second is that while in the past the message of God as sent through Abraham is corrupted to some extent or another by the recipients of the message, the Quran, the holy book of Islam, is sent with the foolproof legal guarantee of non-corruption by God. That God vows or promises to preserve this text uncorrupted. Now, notice here, there is a certain degree of interesting dynamic that will take place in Islamic history and Islamic reality today as well. And then I'll mention these general points and specify as to terrorism, Islamic law and terrorism. And that is why the divine guarantee to protect the Quran is there. In other words, the promise of the divine that the full immunity and protection be given to the literal word of the Quranic text, the holy book of Islam, yet no such guarantee is given as to the interpretive processes that take around the Quran. So in other words, the Quran is the literal word of God, but interpretations, the discourses, the determinations of meaning that arise from the Quranic text is not given the immunity and immutability of the divine guarantee. So God doesn't promise that the determination of Muslim jurists are in fact the divine will, or represent the divine will. Now, so is the Islamic message, to put it sort of bluntly, and is the Islamic message very different on the point of what we call terrorism today, on the point of violence? Is it so different from its predecessors? Because remember that it's difficult to analyze Islam without its claim to be a continuation of previous messages, particularly Judaic and Christian. So really the question is it a point of departure so fundamentally different that it produces a conception of violence and the conception of warfare so remarkably different that one must take note of it? Here, I ask that we adopt a certain degree of sophistication in the way we analyze this, because we must distinguish between the text, the medieval text of the Quran, when Islam comes about, which claims to be the literal word of God, and then the vast interpretive activities of various jurists upon the Quran and various other parts of Islamic tradition for about 1400 years. So let's take some of the Quranic discourse and then move to the interpretive discourse. The Quranic discourse itself uses the word for terrorism in Arabic is irhab, which literally means to cause terror. The Quran itself uses that term once in its text, and it is talking about preparing yourself to be strong or empowering yourself, making yourself strong so that you can invoke fear in the hearts of your enemy. So the Quranic text goes something like this, with my translation. Prepare or make ready among the venues of power, such as horses and weapons, so that you may cast or put fear in the hearts of your enemies. Now, not importantly here, in the Quranic text itself, it is talking not about our conception of terror, but talking about a preemptive claim of strength, of power, in order to avoid warfare. And the Quranic text goes on to say that fitna means sedition, oppression, that oppression is often the result of the arrogance of people when one faction becomes exclusively the source of power, possesses power exclusively, while all others do not. And in a rather interesting discourse, it talks about that God, in order to prevent oppression on earth, it balances people out. It distributes power to people so that no faction, no one group can have an exclusive claim to power. So that, in fact, to emphasize the point, what this part of the Quran is talking about is not anything that of the modern terror that we associate with, but it is quite clear that it's talking about making yourself sufficiently strong, sufficiently powerful to avoid warfare, what we today call deterrence. It is talking about the use of power, or empowerment as a form of deterrence. Elsewhere, the Quran, interestingly enough, refers to two distinct concepts: jihad, which you probably heard quite a bit about today, which is translated holy war, but it's an inaccurate translation. And although it's really interesting, because no matter where I lecture, and I start off by saying, well, jihad is an inaccurate translation and should not be translated as such, and immediately I get a whole bunch of people say, yes, we know, it's not supposed to be holy war, it means striving, working hard, but let's call it holy war anyway. The purist in me is confounded by that attitude. The Quran actually doesn't use jihad to connote warfare. The word that it uses for warfare is qital, word that other than one journalist in the LA Times does not come up at all. And that one journalist in the LA Times, she used it because I gave it to her. The word qital, Q-I-T-A-L, is usually the word that the Quran uses to refer to warfare. Jihad, the Quran uses to refer to a struggle. In fact, it's often talking, and here's the interesting point that I have started out with. It is often talking about jihad as part of a struggle that since Abraham has been going on. This is what we call existential level struggle between good and evil. In other words, the way that the term jihad is consistently used in the Quran is to refer to the struggle of the camp of God, the prophets of God, starting from Abraham, to Moses, to Jesus, to Muhammad, and so on, to establish, to fight off Satan and the evils of Satan and the inner Satan in order to establish the word of God. When the Quran talks about warfare, it talks about qital. And here the Quranic message is, again, very contextual. It at times talks about, and here is an example, fight those who fight God and His Prophet and follow them pursue them, rather, and pursue them wherever they might be. Elsewhere it says, fight in the name of God so that the word of God may be well established and serene. Elsewhere it says, fight those who fight you, but do not transgress, for God does not love those who transgress. Elsewhere it says, as to those who come and cast the hand of peace to you, do not tell them you are not sincere, seeking to fight them and cause aggression, for God does not love the aggressors. Elsewhere, God does not forbid you from making peace with those who seek peace with you, but God forbids you from making peace as to those who have oppressed you and expelled you from your homes. Fight them until you regain your homes, and then do not transgress beyond. The message of the Quran as to qital, as to fighting, I describe it as functional. In other words, it is talking about specific instances, specific occasions, specific occurrences in real life. And it's saying, fight here, don't fight here, restrain here, make peace here, and so on and so forth. When it comes to jihad, which is the more abstract metaphysical concept, there, the Quran is talking about a more fundamental type of struggle, not necessarily through the use of weapons, but nearly prophetic struggle between evil and good. So it becomes such that what Abraham did was jihad. What Moses did was jihad. What the carrying of the Ten Commandments and the tablet was jihad. The suffering of Jesus was jihad. The migration of Muhammad from Mecca to Medina was jihad. The seeking of knowledge is jihad. Enjoining the good and forbidding the evil is jihad. Fasting Ramadan and struggling through it is jihad, and so on and so forth. So the Quran itself is as complex a text, like all medieval texts. If you read in the Old Testament, you find that the Old Testament does not say a single or a unilateral story about war or either.
the Old Testament itself talks about a variety of circumstances, sort of functional cases, in which many things, many different things happen, some of them by our standards horrific and shocking, like the executing of the people of a town, or the enslaving of huge numbers of population, and some of them more benevolent. But it is the rabbinic tradition of the Old Testament which steers and shifts the discourse of the Old Testament into normative moral determinations that lead to certain conclusions. And here, to sum up, if you're really interested in this, you can read my rather boring book on rebellion and violence in Islamic law. It's not only boring, but it's expensive. but, you know, that's Cambridge Press. And I'm happy to tell you I don't make a dime off this book. So, you know, if you buy it, you're not enriching. You're just keeping Cambridge Press alive. where I go into the whole juristic determinations and juristic debates and so on. But in a nutshell, because I'm running out of time and I want to see if I can make anything. In a nutshell, you had two orientations developed in the Islamic juristic tradition. And it is not, or these are not orientations that are that surprising. There is most definitely an orientation which tended to look at acts of terror, what they called kiraba, as corruption on the earth. They read the Quranic text in a way to think of that there are certain things that, regardless of the cause, purpose, or justification, ought not to be done. Cannot be done. Among them, for instance, is rape. Can you use rape as a means of propagating war? Interestingly enough, we see some of the resonance of this orientation in the rather flood of response that has come out of some of the countries today about terrorism. So the Mufti of Egypt had issued a fatwa banning terrorist attacks, and then he engages in a certain definition of them by basically saying anything that targets civilians is a terrorist attack. And as well as a number of Saudi jurists, some Jordanian, a couple of Kuwaitis, and so on and so forth. The second orientation in the Islamic tradition, which tended to be to find morality inseparable from power. And what I mean by this is that it looked at establishing a moral order as a luxury that can be attained only after you are able to assert your power. And so, within that orientation, one it conceded that in principle, it would be wrongful to target civilians, to kill children or women or so on. It said that moral prohibition can be compromised in the case of necessity where it would be impossible to establish power otherwise. That orientation is reflected in very recently Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who is one of the prominent jurists, was having a debate on Al Jazeera channel in which he was discussing he was responding to various jurists who had prohibited terrorist attacks, and he said in there, citing these older jurists in the medieval era, saying, well, you know, yes, in principle, this form of attack would be wrongful, but how else are we going to fight oppression? How else can we respond? And necessities make unlawful things permitted. That's the dicta or the phrase often used. In the contemporary world, between, it is one thing to say in every interpretive tradition, in every legal, one of the things that you know about lawyers, or if you don't, I hope you never find out, is there is determinative clear answers is not their strong point. Lawyers, jurists, are very good about saying on the one hand, on the second hand, on the third hand, on the fourth hand, on the fifth hand, and then ultimately not giving you a response. If you want to be crass about it, you say, well, the response depends on the entire of it. That part of it. Forget, I'm a lawyer myself, so I don't want to dump on it. But jurists, it is not remarkable. It should not cause you pause that there are different schools of thought upon the Quranic discourse. But what does cause one pause is what interpretive orientation Islam, or what interpretive direction Islam has gone in the modern age. And let me propose to you the following. As I started my lecture, I said that Islam is a continuation of the Abrahamic faith, and that there is definitely, when the Quran talks about jihad, it is talking about a struggle that humanity is engaged in rather than Muslims are engaged in. What I fear, though, is that in the modern age, both some Muslims, maybe a good number of Muslims, and a good number of non-Muslims have made Islam into the other that is neither accountable nor accessible to its long tradition of inclusivity. What I mean by that is, you can look at the Islamic tradition and even the jihad tradition and saying that jihad can be a part of the struggle of human beings against things that Muslims struggle against in their civilization. For instance, one of the reasons that Muslims excelled in science and medicine and mathematics and in pharmaceutical was because of this notion that they're engaged in a universal jihad against, whether they describe it as Satan or describe it against ignorance or describe it against the evils of the lack of divinity or whatever it is. But they were engaged in universal humanistic jihad that produced what the Islamic civilization produced. What I fear is that one of the things that happens when civilizations crumble is that people become exclusivist. They lose the confidence to fight a cause on behalf of humanity, and rather fight a cause on behalf of themselves and themselves only. And so within the orientation that tends to look to power and necessity as the raison d'etre of everything, it also tends to create the Islamic message, to posit the Islamic message, to construct it in a way that undermines its universality, its ability to be a part of the Abrahamic faith and engage in what I refer to as a humanistic jihad on behalf of humanity, and to emphasize more of the exclusive particularity of what Muslims, all Muslims, must achieve. While the second school of thought, which had tended to look at certain moral principles that are fundamental and unwavering, regardless of the circumstances, which tended to say that killing of certain people is always wrong because Islam stands for a humanistic moral principle, for a universal moral principle, not for a parochial reality or a power necessity, is the one that needs to be supported and injected in the modern age. And with that, thank you very much. How much time do I have for a question and answer?
2 minutes or so.
Yes. You know, you're speaking to doctors, and doctors are tenderhearted, and doctors are used to patients coming up with reasons for things, the situation that maybe have no cause, like why do I have to have breast cancer, or why did I get the breast cancer? It's easy to justify things, it's easy to explain things with nice, fancy words. But my question is this, if, and I believe that it is, I grew up in a country, well, I had to study as a Jewish person in the moral arts for 10 years, I don't believe, just like you do, I hope, that there is nothing in the Quran that justifies what happened here on September 11th, or what happened in the Middle East by suicide bombers. But if this is un-Islamic, then why don't clergymen or leaders in the Arab world, in the Islamic world, condemn it once and for all? This is not Islamic. Why don't we hear this every day and every second of every day?
Well, one is not an issue of fancy words. Normativity, thought, ideas. One of the dangers, one of the biggest problems of fundamentalists who have hijacked Islamic tradition is that they tend to have been, actually all of them, are either engineers or medical doctors. No offense to them. The reason is that they think in terms of black and white. They don't understand nuances. They don't understand shade. They don't understand normativities and abstractions. And so they take the Islamic tradition, which is a moral tradition, and they want it to yield fast and easy black and white responses. These are not fancy words, and this is not to justify anything. This is simply to take account of a reality. The reality is that you have a text of the Quran that says the things that I say it says. I didn't make these texts up. And so, do you ignore that, or do you take account that in fact it says it? Second, the reality is you have a juristic tradition that developed a very hostile discourse to Hirab and Qatl al-Ghir, which is the acts of terror. Do you ignore that and say, yeah, but you know, it's not cited in the modern age, and all that matters is in the modern age.
Sir, another respect, it did not answer my question. Why don't you and others condemn the fact?
Well, I'm getting this. So do you ignore that, or are they a part of the normativities and the abstractions that apply and pertain? Now, as to why haven't you condemned these acts, that's absurd. That's simply absurd. Because one of the, I as someone who has been trained in jurisprudence, in Islamic jurisprudence for most of my life and certified as a high-ranking jurist, I was one of the first people who wrote an article in the LA Times and put my neck out, condemning, not only condemning the attacks, but going further. I published an article before 9/11 and after 9/11. The thing is, in addition, when I just finished telling you in the lecture that the Mufti of Egypt himself, the highest ranking jurist, not only condemned these attacks, but condemned them in no unequivocal terms. Well, I just also finished telling you that Yusuf al-Qaradawi, one of the highest ranking jurists, was having a debate with other jurists on public TV about whether these attacks are lawful or not. What I would pose is this. Why is it that there are some non-Muslims so dead set in their hate for Muslims that when Muslims say what is moral and good and humane, they don't want to hear? They only want to hear what is ugly and what is inhumane and unacceptable. I turn the gaze upon you.
I think that's unfair. Most of the people I know are not Muslims, but know Muslims. And they don't behave in a way that is in any way intrusive or ugly to other Muslims. So all we expect from them is a tolerance and an integration into our democratic society.
Well, we said the same thing, of course, about the Chinese when we passed the Chinese exclusion laws, and we said the same thing about the Japanese when we put them in internment camps. We said the same thing. So, I mean, our books are replete with references about Jews in the same way where we said that Jews fundamentally cannot integrate in our way of life. And we, in fact, some of what the British officers were saying when you had the Ergon group in Palestine going around blowing things, including British targets, the British were saying, well, you know, those two just don't have the conceptions of warfare that we do. And as we know, that we understood the Ergon, and we understood the bombing of King David Hotel, and we understood what the British said about the Americans, and we understood what we said about the Japanese or the Chinese or so on, as contextual, for every indecent Muslim you meet, for every Muslim that goes off and does an intolerant act, there is out there about 10,000 Muslims who've never hurt anyone, never committed an act of terrorism, never think of committing an act of terrorism, who work alongside with you and are dependable moral human beings. So by what logic do we come to this group and say to those who are not guilty and say, defend yourself, because people who belong to your same faith have offended us or have wronged us? As a Muslim myself, notice from my perspective, how much more do I have to bear? As a Muslim, I have to worry as much as everyone here who's not Muslim about the threat of a terrorist attack. Because if terrorism happens, I'll be killed like everyone else. The terrorists are not going to say, oh, you're a Muslim. Well, let us take the plane down and allow you to leave. I'm dead, like everyone. Second, as a Muslim, now dealing with non-Muslims, not only that, but I have to constantly overcome the presumption of suspicion. I don't have a rap sheet, I don't have a record, and my publications are out there, but yet with every encounter, every person I meet, it is not enough for me to say, read my writings or watch my interviews on TV. I must prove to them, from the burden of proof is upon me to say, I'm nice, I'm decent. Please don't suspect me or suspect my son or suspect my wife. Don't think ill of me. And it's not that's quite a burden. Third, on top of all of that, I must deal with the fanatic Muslims who I have gone out of my way to condemn, and the fact that I am a walking, living, breathing target for them at any point in time. They will never bother you individually. In other words, they will never get your name and your address and your place of residence, but they would bother me because I speak up against them, and on top of that, I don't get credit for speaking up against them because the presumption is so heavily against me. This is not me as an individual, but it is so many Muslims who feel this way. And I think we simply make things much, much worse for Muslims when we force them into this rather defensive, apologetic position that becomes all-encompassing of their life. I handle it because I'm an obnoxious lawyer, but others don't.
One question. For one thing, take my word that the community here is very much open-minded, and the fact that you are here from a different view and talking to them, you got to present that how open-minded they are. My own question is that why is that in the Islamic world we see many countries having a suppressive, undemocratic system, too much through the Islam? And also, is it theocracy has something to do against democracy? And in your opinion, should governments be secular rather than? Because the more, I came from Iran, and the more Islamic they are, the more virulent, the more suppressive they are. I mean, God forbid, you cannot go, even though they claim to be very Islamic, no other view can be tolerated.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good question. In Muslim countries, the picture again gets rather complicated because If you take some of the most repressive governments, like the Iraqi government, the Syrian government, the Egyptian government, right? They are not secularists. I mean, they're not theocratic. They're secular. In fact, in the case of the Iraqi and Syrian, they are vigilantly secular. Now, of course, I believe that ruling in the name of God not only do I believe that it does not produce democracy, but I think it's immoral, because then God becomes responsible for all the mistakes of human beings. But aside with the point I want to make, a government or an institution, but that aside, the fact is that the despotism and repression is a very serious problem in most countries, Muslim countries, and whether these countries are theocratically oriented or secularly oriented. Now, I can tell you that I don't buy that it is an issue of Oriental despotism. I think that religion can be used to justify a lot of different things in the same way that you can use anything to justify a lot of different things. And I think that religion, Islam, can be used to justify despotism, but it can also be used to justify more egalitarian democratic notions if you emphasize on the idea of shura and bay'ah and aqd and all of this stuff. But the problem I think is a very significant one, because I believe that despotism does give birth to fanaticism, that it is fundamentally a polarizing reality, that because the government sucks power to itself exclusively, the only way you can resist the government is to negate the government exclusively. And when you learn to negate the government exclusively, the power dynamics become very polarized and very, very dichotomous and black and white. And you learn you're either dead or you're alive. The game is you're either win, so you stay alive, or you lose, so you die. And part of that is it becomes ingrained in your psychology, that you don't value, since death is so possible, you don't value life that much. You learn that you enter into a game of zero-sum game. You could die or live. And so life itself eventually becomes whimsical. It comes and goes, it's sort of easy come, easy go type logic. And I've seen that. I mean, I grew up in the Middle East, and I've seen that time and time. There are a couple of things, though. One is that we cannot ignore the reality that most of these governments, in the case of Iran, I think it's not, but in the case of Saudi Arabia, or in the case of Egypt, or in the case of Jordan, or in that these are governments that stay in power to a good measure through our good offices. I mean, we help them stay in power, in particular in someone like Kuwait or Saudi Arabia. We don't play a minor role. And we, from the days of Kissinger, we seem to have had a realpolitik orientation that it is much easier to deal with a people that have a dictator ruling over them than to deal with a people that don't. Because a dictator, you can speak to the dictator and he can represent the will of all the country. And then you can turn around and say, well, as to the opposition and all of that, that's your problem, right? And he says, sure thing. You know, those people who are opposing the oil concessions of Aramco, et cetera, I'll take care of them. When you have a democratic government, it's more difficult. Then you have to worry about, the opposition party, and this person is saying that, and I don't know if I can really do this because I've got people in the opposition who will get mad, and so on. And since the days of Kissinger, we definitely, and I don't say it started with Kissinger, but he established he made it into an art form, so that when I get people hired in the State Department, going out of law school,
the paradigm of realpolitik and Kissingerism, as we call it, is very strong, very, very strong. If you're a non-Kissingerist, you're not going to likely get hired in the State Department. And so, and part of that is to say we want a dictator to represent that country to us. We don't want to get deal with different people and complexities in the countries and so on. This makes things very, very complicated, because I think it feeds into fanaticism, Islamic fanaticism. I genuinely ask if what happened with the Shah and the United States, if people like Khomeini would have ever gained the popularity that they gained. You know, Khomeini was, most of his writings for a long time in Iran were ignored. And it was and most of his writings, in fact, are not accessible to people. I mean, he sort of became a symbol and it caught like fire. So I think that we need to be far more responsible about our getting into bed with dictators and calling them our friends and fighting wars to restore them in power and so on and so forth. One of the most shameful periods in our history is that let's not forget that we, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and us, we were the main supporters of Osama bin Laden. We were the main people who gave money and arms to the Taliban to beat everyone else, because we thought that Osama bin Laden will follow what Saudi Arabia tells him and will be a good boy, and Saudi Arabia will represent Saudi Arabia will tell bin Laden what to say, think, or do, and then we talk to the Saudis and he's our simply support. It's stupid. I mean, at the time, I remember I wrote articles and gave lectures and I said, people, what the heck are you doing? Do you really think that bin Laden is just going to get his orders from the Saudi government? Are you insane? But basically the attitude of the vast majority of people that I talked to in the State Department or White House or whatever was that you're naive. You don't know what you're talking about. You just don't like the Saudis, and that's the problem. So that's one. Another shameful episode is that we used to call Saddam Hussein our friend throughout the time he fought Iran. I mean, even at the time that he was lobbing missiles at Tehran and slaughtering civilians and so on, I was living in Kuwait at the time. And I remember these things discreetly, but Saddam was a good guy. And Saudi Arabia said he was a good guy, Kuwait said he was a good guy, because he was slaughtering the Persians. And can you imagine if the Iranian revolution was ever weak? Well, it became very strong when people realized that the whole of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the countries of the Gulf and Iraq are out to slaughter Persians without reserve. Things, you know, whatever goes around comes around, and if you treat people with a certain level of immorality, you suffer the immorality ultimately. And I think it's time for us to bury Kissingerism in our politics.
Along those lines,
I have two questions. One,
I'm sorry. Along those lines, you mentioned the Revolutionary War. Now, that was not a religious war. The United States purposely separated religion from the government. We have a judiciary, legislature, and executive. The Twin Towers, the response of the Twin Towers was not a religious response, it was the response of the government. And we've purposely gone out of our way to keep religion out of our policies. Now, it seems to me, if Bin Laden had any grief against this government, why doesn't he say, I am declaring war because 1, 2, 3? But it seems this whole thing has been a smokescreen of religion. And I don't even see where religion has anything to do with what's going on.
Well, I mean, I agree with you, except I don't think you can separate people. You take people as you find them. I don't think that people, if someone if the way they construct their identity has a religious component, it's very hard for the prophet to come and say, well, I'm going to put this religious component on the side and just act upon a non-religious component.
But this government is composed of different religions. In the United States, it's a multi-religious group, and they all get along together under the law of the government.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm not saying that we're engaged in a religious war. I don't think Bin Laden is either. I mean, Bin Laden was quite clear that everything that has come out of his mouth is that he is very upset about American troops in Saudi Arabia.
Why doesn't he say that's the reason?
Well, he does, but he couches it in all types of religious terms because he can't promise heaven to anyone unless he couches it in religious terms. And I think that's, you know, that's part of the rhetoric and the propaganda that he engages in, is to sort of bring in an element of heaven and an automatic ticket to heaven and all of that stuff. But the other thing that I want to say is, and I know that this is controversial, I think that despite of Bush's nice statements about, well, this is Muslims are peace-loving people and so on, I think that Ashcroft and the Bush administration are confusing, in fact, in their mind between Islam and Bin Laden, and that the enforcement policies of the FBI and the INS since 9/11, despite all the promises they made, and the new U.S. Patriot Act, which is one of the worst civil rights acts passed in recent memories, and the fact that Ashcroft himself has very strong foundations in Christian fundamentalism, as a Christian fundamentalist, really does risk of changing that paradigm that you're talking about. One of the things that the media has not noticed yet, but I'm willing to defend it, is that if you remember after 9/11, there was a whole group of Israelis and Jews that were arrested, and some of them remain in detention today. And a lot of people sort of just look the other way and ignore it. Well, part of the reason is that Ashcroft has the same ungenerous views of Judaism that he has of Islam. And his world view of what's good is disturbing to me. And the law that he sponsored into effect is extremely disturbing to me. And I think that it is remarkably dangerous to give this type of, I mean, it's ultimately, if someone would have told you before 9/11, listen, we have a choice to go to war, and this war is going to cost us 5,000 lives, but the return for this war is that we don't want military courts in the United States, and we don't want the government to be able to snoop at liberty. And in other words, it's going to cost us 5,000 lives to protect our identity as Americans. Would you think it's worth it? And I think most Americans would have said it's worth it. But what is horrendously alarming for me is that we allow these people to railroad us into forgetting what we're all about and to say yes to military courts, even yes perhaps to torture, even yes perhaps to unlawful detentions and without access to attorneys, without any crimes charged. Then what the heck are we all about? I mean, we're supposed to be about something, about a principle. And when terrorists come, and in my view, when I talk to, if I'm very active in the human rights field, and when people, you know, come and say, well, you know, we're fighting terrorists, the Egyptian government or the Saudi government or whatever government say, but, you know, so we need to use torture, and we need to use military force, and we need to execute people and so on. And I say, no, I'm sorry, that's not an excuse. you must respect human rights regardless. But now, recently, what I've been hearing is, well, you know, you Americans do it. When it came to you and you started being threatened by terrorism, you set up military courts and started writing articles in the Wall Street Journal about how terrorism is okay, about how torture is okay, and about we can use doctors to help us break down individuals psychologically. I think I was already quite depressed after 9/11, but after the U.S. Patriot Act, I became I struggle with serious depression every single day.
I'd like to ask two questions, one for information and one for opinion. Does the Quran define what is good and what is evil?
That's a good question. The Quran refers to the good, I mean, it refers to broad categories. So for instance, it talks about adl, justice. It talks about, when it says, don't transgress, it says, well, that's atadu, but there is no definition of transgression. It says something like, what Allah saw with haq, speak truthfully, but it doesn't define how to speak truthfully. And part of it, I think that the Quran, quite frankly, and Muslims are there, but anyway, part of it is that the Quran is neither a book of philosophy nor is it a book of law. And I think that Muslim fundamentalists themselves try to put on the Quran more than it can bear. They come and they treat it like a book of law or a book of philosophy or a book of... And even some Muslim liberals do the same. I was in a conference here in California, and some guy came up and said, well, Muslims don't need a constitutional document because the Quran is our constitution. And, you know, the comment is, God is not a constitutional drafter. God is not Thomas Jefferson or John Hamilton, and it doesn't take away anything from God to say that God didn't draft a constitutional document. And to try to treat the Quran as a constitutional document, I think is ultimately degrades the Quran and renders it subject to abuse and manipulation and corruption by human beings. So
the Quran is an interpretation, is subject to interpretation.
Absolutely.
Most people who have the desire and the will and the ability to interpret it and force their interpretation on the rest of the world.
Right.
And so my next question, for your opinion, it would seem that with the vision of Islam that is now epitomized by the terrorist organizations, that there may well be a potential clash of basic civilizations, Western civilization and fundamentalist Islamic civilization. It seems to me that is the area in which the moderate Muslim has the most potential influence and an obligation to do something to save the whole world, not just Islam and not just Western civilization. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, I think, assuming, the clash of civilizations is, quite frankly, I think you can speak right now of a Western civilization. You can speak of an Islamic crumbled, deteriorated civilization, but I think it's a very, very unequal fight. And what I mean by this is that there will be a lot of confrontation, there will be a lot of bombings and so on and so forth, but as we saw, if you remember during the Iraq War, the Iraqi army crumbled so fast. I also knew, I knew that the Taliban were going to crumble very fast as well. And let me tell you one of the really important points that I think is often ignored and neglected by all types of people when we talk about this. There is a reason that the Iraqi army crumbled, and there's a reason that the Taliban crumbled, and there's a reason that these types of governments crumble. And prime among the reasons is They're not liked by the people that they control. The people are not willing to defend them or die for them. One of the things that happened with the Taliban is the number of people that basically turned around and said, you know, we can now breathe a sigh of relief and went after them. This is ignored because if you want to be a barometer of where Muslims act, my own view is the vast majority of Muslims are sick and tired of despotism, of having their dignity ignored, of having their human rights violated. I think the vast majority of Muslims, you come to, all they want is to feel like human beings with dignity in the world. And people like the Taliban and the Iraq's government and Saudi Arabian government don't do that. They degrade them more than anyone else. Now, as to the role of moderates and so on, I couldn't agree with you more. I don't think, and I say this and I've said it in print, the main burden is not upon non-Muslims to extend the hand of understanding. I expect non-Muslims to be tolerant as decent human beings and respect the human rights of Muslims, and as Muslims ought to respect the human rights of others and so on. But the main burden is on Muslim moderates who know the tradition, who know it intimately, who can engage in the intellectual battle and make a dent. The main thing is, there are two factors that make it hard, and here I speak as an insider, not as an outsider. The first is that despotism of many of the Islam, of the Muslim governments makes it very hard because, for instance, I cannot go to Saudi Arabia. I have been banned from ever entering Saudi Arabia. Whether I can go to Egypt is highly questionable as well. That doesn't just limit my access, but it also points to how, as a human being, I'm vulnerable. Second, a lot of my energy is spent responding, a lot of my energy and the energy of people similarly situated is spent responding to people like Joseph Bedansky or Steve Emerson or Daniel Pipes, or, in other words, people who I believe are Islamophobics, who truly, in their heart of hearts, hate Muslims and everything Muslim. Whether it's because of the Arab-Israeli conflict, whether they believe because Islam is the main instigator against Israelis, it doesn't. And what I find is that with so much energy and time spent in just trying to respond to these guys, that takes away from the energy and time that I have to engage in the inner interpretive process of, in other words, engaging the fundamentalists on the Muslim side. It's very difficult to lead a battle against non-Muslim fundamentalists, that's what I call the Islamophobics, and Muslim fundamentalists at the same time. And I just wish that one side of the battle calm down sufficiently so I can engage more intimately the Muslim fundamentalists. I wanna put this last point. In my six books, all of them, all six, are directed at, addressed to other Muslims primarily. In other words, the Muslim fundamentalists. But I have squeezed this stuff in the midst of having to spend so much time writing articles responding to the Daniel Pipes and Emersons of the world. And after a while, it's just very draining and tiring, and you start feeling increasingly, universally hated on both sides.
You know, there's one word we haven't used in this entire discussion, and I wonder if it appears in your books, and that word is oil.
Oil, oh yeah.
Now, you know, we dance around and we talk about philosophy. Basically, the United States, in spite of its various transgressions in the past, and we all recognize what they've been, are fundamentally, when you get down to the general population, decent people, with a very liberal attitude, concerned about human rights, and ultimately wanting to do the right thing. Problem is, we often don't know what the right thing is. But what we do know, we do it. we're dealing with people who, which we're trying to deal with regimes that control oil. And it isn't that we believe their philosophy.
Yeah.
It's because we need their oil. Well, how do you get around that? What's the answer? You know, we can castigate one another forever, but until we resolve that issue, I don't, it all sounds like rhetoric.
Well, I think one, there are a couple of things of that. In my own view, the biggest, there are two things that have truly been a disaster for Islam in the modern age. One is the Arab-Israeli conflict, because most people look at Islam only through the prism of the Arab-Israeli conflict. So they're really interested in Islam only to the extent it relates to the, and it's, of course, I mean, the fact that that Arabs are only 10% of the Muslim world, that Islam has a long history in which its relation with Jews and so on is only a small part of, etc., etc., is all ignored because everything becomes filtered through that prism. The second big disaster on Islam, I believe, is oil. Not just because of the interest of outside powers in penetrating Muslim countries and controlling and because of oil, but even more so because I don't believe in easy money. I don't believe that easy cash can produce morality. And one of the things that easy cash does, the surplus of cash, is that it makes people intellectually and morally lazy. And I believe that since the 70s, the oil-rich countries have used their wealth to spread a type of Islam that is morally lazy and morally not introspective, not critical. In fact, to sort of dismiss the value of thought and morality in itself. One of the things that I and myself and some other people, we have gone out of our way never to put easy money. As you can imagine, that as an expert in Islamic law, the biggest market for Islamic law is the Gulf. But never to allow your pocket to be penetrated by the very comfortable and easy money that comes from oil, because it alters your psychology.
One last question.
I'm concerned about the Quran. I'm quoting, not from the Quran, but this author, Norman Stillman, who Jews of our land, quotes statements of the Quran. For example, this one. One, O you who believe, paint not the Jews and Christians as friends. They are friends to one another. Whoever of you befriends them is one of them. Allah does not guide the people who do evil. And Surah 5-51. And there's about a dozen of these things. And what concerns me is you have no influence over the vast majority of Muslims who believe in Islam. The Quran has the influence. Quran has these dozen that this author picks out, and other people have other quotes of the Quran. This is what worries me, concerns me.
Well, one of the points, one of the problems I was talking about, the author of this book, I categorize him as another Islamophobe. And the reason for that is what I must presume to be simple, straightforward, dishonest. The Quran, in fact, doesn't say in Surah 5 or in the various parts, and I'll go over all of it. Don't take the Jews and Christians as friends. And what it says is, do not take them as awliya. The word is awliya. And awliya means do not take them as allies in war. That's what that means. In Arab. So I can't, when I talk about my partner, if I talk about a friend, I call him Sadiqi,
Sahibi, Hamimi, Akhi is my brother, but if I'm talking about an ally, I call him a wali, or a master, sometimes also called a wali. And so the Quran is clearly talking, and as has been understood by Muslims for centuries, is clearly talking about a contextual period where Muslims are engaging in warfare against the kuffar, the non-believers of Mecca, and they are being offered certain alliances by Christian and Jewish tribes, and the Quran comes and says, no, that's a bad idea, don't enter in these alliances. And in that same context, in another verse, which I'm sure the author of this book quotes, because that's another one of the verses that Islamophobics love to quote, in which says that you will find those who are most, the version or the language they always quote is, you will find the Jews to be the most hostile to Muslims. And again, the intellectual dishonesty is amazing, because what the Quran says in the Arabic, not in the English, is that, and it goes on in the verse, that you will find that for you, meaning for your situation, in your time, that those who tend to have the greatest degree of enmity against you are the Jews. So it's talking about the Jews of the area, of the period. And then it goes on to say, but some of them bear you no ill will, for they are people who fear God. And what this author and others like Emerson and Vesky do, they come in and quote, slice off this nice part and put on it the right language, and voila, you've got a monster of a religion that, lo and behold, somehow managed to capture the hearts of a billion people in the world, to create a civilization of great beauty and science and tolerance and so on. But lo and behold, we discover today that this is the religion of hatred and violence and anti-Semitism. It's like a guy was saying, well, isn't it true that the Quran is anti-Semitic? To the extent that every religion claims to possess the exclusive truth, it's anti everything else. But to the extent that it considers Moses and Jews as part of the people of the book and part of the Abrahamic faith, it cannot. The Quran also says, and I don't know if he quoted this or not, often they don't, that God has sent to Christians and Jews and Sabians a book and a way and a law. To each of you is a way and a law. Verily, Jews, Christians, and Sabians who do good and are just have nothing to fear and no reason to regret. Now, again, interpretive, hermeneutics, in other words, as a jurist, I can approach this text and I can explore its moral connotations. And I can come out and say, listen, what I understand from this is universal message of acceptance of and argue with and fight with those who try to present a message of hate from Islam. Or alternatively, I can read it and say, I'm sure that God, when God wrote it, he was trying to kiss up to Western forces, so I'm just going to ignore it. Because that's often the attitude, is that, you're just pro-Western. You're just trying to spin things off that would solve problems with the West. I'm dealing with text that is medieval, that is 1,400 years old, long before there was ever a United States or the West. And whatever I find in the text, I interpret, because I believe that God has given me that right, I interpret in light of my contemporary biases and subjectivities. But that's part of the challenge. Fully aware, though, that none of my subjectivities and biases represent God. God represents God's self, and God is up there, and who knows? In the final day, we'll all figure it out, we'll work it out somehow. But as far as this earth is concerned, I do my best efforts, and the results of the best efforts are mine. Always mine, always human, not God's.
Thank you very much. Wonderful.